the myth of the NGO being, you know, we live in a world that's growing increasingly unequal, where there's a huge gap, a growing gap between the rich countries and the rich in the rich countries and the poor in the poor countries. And that NGOs are kind of perceived as a way of addressing this situation. They're perceived as being grassroots. They're perceived as being independent and working, you know, closely with the poor in their interests. And as speaking, in some cases, speaking for global civil society, speaking for, a fairer and more just world. This book is really a challenge to all that, and I think the general conclusion that I come to is that Canadian development NGOs serve instead to stifle dissent within Canada on international issues, and they serve to either co-opt or disrupt or even combat, in some cases, oppositional movements in the global south that are fighting against neoliberalism and fighting against inequality and fighting for a better life. And that's not the image that most people have. I think I need to explain where it came from, where this idea came from. For me, I started questioning NGOs through my implication with Haiti solidarity activism. Haiti is known as the Republic of NGOs. It has more NGOs per capita than any other country on earth. They're spread across the face of the country quite widely, and they're really ubiquitous, and you can't miss them. My interest in Haiti started with the 2004 coup d'etat in Haiti. And on February 29th, 2004, the democratically elected government of Haiti was overthrown. The president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was hustled by US Marines onto a State Department plane and was flown out of the country. And an unelected government took power and basically ruled the country in a reign of terror for the next 2 years. And myself and other people started investigating what had happened in Haiti and how Canada was involved, and we found that Canada was really deeply involved both in the planning, in the lead-up of the coup d'etat, and in what came after. The Canadian government had troops on the ground in Haiti when Aristide was flown out of the country. So this is the democratically elected president being taken out of the country, and we had troops there securing the airport, the Port-au-Prince's airport. Those troops there were there and occupied the country for a number of months afterwards. Canada also sent police trainers down to Haiti, and they were training the Haitian National Police, which was, in the wake of the coup d'etat, was really turned upside down and militarized. So former members of the military were integrated into the police force, and they were basically sent pretty much daily into the slums, the areas where the support for the government, the elected government, was strongest. And they would go in there every day at the worst point, and they would be shooting up the place. They would shoot anyone who was there. And they were killing people day in and day out. And there were many human rights reports that were coming out about this, and so, and Canada was really actively supporting it. In addition to the police training, they were also providing huge amounts of foreign aid to the unelected government. They were defending it in international forums, at CARICOM, at the UN, and so on. And so, we, as Haiti solidarity activists, we were outraged by what Canada was doing, and we started, trying to get the word out, organizing amongst ourselves, inviting people from Haiti to come speak about the situation. And one of the places we turned for support that we expected would, our efforts would have kind of some resonance was some development NGOs in Montreal, one in particular, Alternatives. We went to them because we knew them from our implication in the anti-globalization movement, and we suggested that they publish an article about what was going on in their monthly newspaper. We suggested that they help us organize a delegation down to Haiti, a human rights fact-finding delegation. And pretty quickly we discovered that we were kind of up against a brick wall. There was absolutely no openness whatsoever to what we were talking about. And we had a reasonably positive opinion of this organization. And we thought, they're on the left of the NGO world. Why not? What's the deal? And we looked into it, and it, you know, they were receiving millions of dollars for contracts in Haiti after the coup. The coup was really a big boon for them, and they were getting millions from CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency, which is a branch of the federal government that sends is responsible for development aid. And so, you know, the more we looked into it, the more we found that they not only were getting lots of money for their work in Haiti after the coup, for work with groups that had supported the coup, they were also they received 75% of their annual budget from CEDA. And so this was really the kind of the point where we started questioning the whole idea of NGOs as independent of the state, as autonomous organizations that are doing things because of the benevolence of their volunteers and you know, because of their values. And we started to see just how tangled up NGOs really are with the state.
This is Michael Welch for CQW. I'm joined right now by Nick Barry Shaw. He is co-author with Drew Oja Joya of... Drew Oja Jay of the book Paved with Good Intentions, Canada's Development NGOs from Idealism to Imperialism. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, could you just maybe help clarify, when you talk about NGOs, non-governmental organizations, what precisely are we talking about?
That's a very good question. They're really hard to pin down, you know, because if you ask 10 people what development is, you'll get 10 different answers. And, you know, the term NGO, non-governmental organization, is really equally slippery. It says, well, we're not government, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. In the book, we sort of have a counterintuitive way of defining NGO, and we define development NGOs as those organizations that are nonprofit organizations doing work in the global south and that take money from the Canadian government. And so it's kind of counterintuitive because they're supposed to be non-governmental, but it actually fits quite well with those organizations that most people perceive to be non-governmental organizations doing development work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything from Oxfam to Development and Peace to, you know, World Vision and so on. All these groups take money in varying degrees from the Canadian government, from CEDA.
Mm-hmm. And there are analogs of this set up elsewhere in the world, correct?
Yeah. It's in the United States, it's very common. I think in most of the other Western European nations, they have a similar kind of setup of funding development organizations, development NGOs. And it's something I think that really came up with the rise of neoliberalism in the 1980s. With this kind of change in development thinking and with this kind of renewed offensive by the capitalist elite to really remake the third world in their interests, mm-hmm. Open it up to corporate investment, open up trade to their products, have access to natural resources that are there, and so on and so forth. You know, the NGOs really emerge out of that conjuncture.
Mm. Now, what was the very first NGO that basically started expressing itself on the national scene?
Yeah, there isn't really any like first NGO. I mean, a lot of the NGOs in Canada, the oldest ones, kind of trace their roots back to missionary organizations, and so there's that link there already between, you know, colonialism previously and development. You know, what's known as development today, it's something that's not often underlined enough, and I think. In some ways, development NGOs play a role that's in some ways analogous to the missionaries that they did in the 19th century under colonialism, under formal colonialism. Aside from the kind of church-linked missionary organizations that became development NGOs, there's also organizations like Oxfam. Originally started as a war charity, sending aid. They were founded in 43. They were sending aid to Greece during the Second World War because of the famine that was happening because there was an Allied blockade of Greece. And so mm-hmm. they started like that, and then you know, as the war wound down and the demand for humanitarian aid in Europe lessened, Oxfam and other kind of war charities like that kind of shifted their focus to the rapidly decolonizing you know, global South, and started doing, you know, development work there.
Mm-hmm. So that sort of that consistent connection that between the development, the boom of the NGOs and neoliberalism as it started expressing itself in the 1980s period, is it, could you maybe give us maybe a specific example?
Yeah.
Like, can we point you to certain countries in which we're starting to see that being expressed?
Yeah, well, in the book, one example in particular that we look at is Ghana. And we use it as kind of like a case example of this more general phenomenon of social funds. And so basically what was happening in the 1980s was the IMF and the World Bank and Canada and other, you know, wealthy nations were making their aid to third world states conditional on them adopting these market reforms. You know,
the structural adjustment.
The structural programs. Adjustment programs, exactly. And, you know, this had really devastating consequences for industry, for agriculture, for social services. It really kind of amounted to a broad-based assault on the living conditions, on the living standards of poor people in these countries. And not surprisingly, there was a lot of resistance to these policies. There were riots. There were, I think, 147 IMF riots in countries in the third world during the period from 1979 to like 1990. There was huge upheaval caused by this this agenda that was being really pressed on third world countries, and Western, you know, planners, Western development planners started worrying, like, oh, like, you know, if things continue to get out of hand, if things continue to get worse, we're going to, you know, we're not going to be able to continue with this, with these reforms, because it'll just be too politically hot, you know, too politically difficult to push them through. And so one of the things, the innovation that they came up with were social funds. This idea that, yes, well, while the government is going to be cutting back on healthcare, on education, while it's going to be liberalizing trade and, you know, having its farmers get flooded by foreign imports of food, at the same time, we'll fund some projects through these social funds. We'll pool our aid in these social funds, and those social funds will fund NGOs mm-hmm. to carry out kind of palliative projects to help the poor who are, you know, help mitigate the social costs of adjustment, as they put it.
I know that there are several examples you could point to, but the one that really is coming to the forefront of my mind is Afghanistan, because we keep hearing this line, you know, we're there to help the Afghan people. Mm-hmm. Look at the hospitals we're building. Look at the mm-hmm. roads and all of that. And I think it's pretty clear to a lot of our listeners, because we've done a lot of examination of the critique of the war. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a sense there where these organizations, their work is being pushed to the forefront as an example of how the intervention in Afghanistan was a good thing.
Yeah, and I think that was very conscious on the government's part. Doing the research for this book, I got some documents from a journalist named Anthony Fenton. He sent them to me, and they were basically, the government was looking at polls that it had conducted, kind of, you know, private secret polls of public opinion, and they said, you know, well, when we present the war to the public as this, like, you know, a war, what it is, you know, they don't really like it that much. But when we present it as in, you know, an effort in reconstruction and development, and we put an emphasis on, you know, women's rights, that passes a lot better. And so I think the reliance of the, you know, both the liberals before and the conservatives after, throughout the whole prosecution of this war, on NGOs has really been attuned to that domestic calculation of political advantage of being able to present this war as something other than it's not, you know, other than it is. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because on the ground in Afghanistan, it hasn't had the kind of mollifying effect that they would have hoped. You know, putting all this money into these NGOs, and in Afghanistan after the invasion, there had been very few NGOs in Afghanistan prior to 2001, and afterwards there was a huge boom in NGOs because of this, you know, influx of aid, and influx of aid in particular going to NGOs for NGO projects. Mm-hmm. And these NGOs proliferated, but report after report kind of demonstrated was that the Afghan people weren't benefiting very much from this, and that it tended to be, a very small segment of the population in Afghanistan who are benefiting, the middle classes, the people who had university education, the people in the cities, and the people who are basically the partners for, Canadian NGOs in Afghanistan. So they did very well for themselves, and they built huge offices, and they, clogged the streets of Kabul with their 4x4s. But the ordinary Afghan continued to, sink deeper and deeper into poverty despite all this aid. Mm-hmm. And that created a lot of resentment. And this came up in parliamentary reports, and this came up in a number of different sources that we looked at in the book, where, the Afghan people are frustrated and resentful with the presence of NGOs because of that disconnect between what they're experiencing and the handful of people who are profiting off of this helping enterprise.
Yeah, and talking about who's profiting, you have people who are contributing their money to these NGOs with the hope that, it's going to help people. And have you analyzed, or broken down where all that funding ends up going? I mean, is it going to, those core, some sort of core development in those countries, or how much is going back to the countries of origin?
Mm-hmm. I think it was in a book by Roger Riddell called About Foreign Aid, where he was talking about how much of the money was spent on administration costs. And this is something NGOs often kind of bring up. They say, we're so much better than the official aid agencies like the Canadian International Development Agency, or working through governments, because our overheads are lower, we're more flexible, we're less bureaucratic, and all this stuff. And they cite, 5-10% of the money that, you give us will go to administration costs, and the rest will go straight to the poor, kind of. That's the implication. And Riddell, in his book, he says, that's not what's going on, because a lot of the money that is set aside is for project costs. And this is kind of an accounting game that they play. They say, that money is for accounting costs, project costs, but it's really going to fund office expenses in the country, the beneficiary country. It's going to pay for staff. It's going to pay for secretaries. It's going to pay for, for SUVs. It's going to pay for laptops and so on and so forth. And so it's a lot of the money is, and he estimated that a conservative estimate is that 70% of the funds that are going through NGOs is spent on these aspects of the endeavor. And so about, only 30%, and that's a generous estimate. He says it's probably lower, less than 30% for other organizations, but 30% at most is going to the people on the ground. And the most of it is serving to kind of to pay the salaries and the lifestyle of the people working in the NGOs, and that's who you find benefiting the most.